our time in the Word. I want you to open your Bibles with me, beginning in 1 Peter. So I want to take advantage of this opportunity here. It's Mother's Day, and it is something that is to be honored. You look to the Word of God, and you see in the Bible that the Lord and the history of God's redemptive plan, there's a high honor and a respect and a love and a blessing given to families and given to the structure of family and being a parent or a mother. And we've all been raised in a family. We've all had parents, grandparents, and the impact that they have in our life. And I just want us to look this morning in honor of this role in our life for a mother, an honorable mother. I want us to look at what that is in Scripture, starting here in 1 Peter chapter 5, which isn't necessarily talking about the family, but in verse 5, in the middle there, I just want you to listen to these words, and I'm going to build from this to where we're going to go. It says, "Clothe yourselves, all of you, with humility toward one another. For God opposes the proud and gives grace to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time he may exalt you, casting all your anxieties on him because he cares for you. Be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. Resist him, firm in your faith, knowing that the same kinds of suffering are being experienced by your brotherhood throughout the world. And after you have suffered a little while, the God of all grace, who has called you to his eternal glory in Christ, will himself restore, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. To him be the dominion forever and ever. Amen." There is a passage there that I would love to expound on, and there's great truths and great exhortations in those texts. But what I want us to do is look at a person who experienced that, who knows what those words are. Someone in the Old Testament, before those words are written, it's as if those words were written reflecting upon this person's life. And it's a person that would be surprising to the world that we would even look at and say, wow, here is an honorable person. And it's in the book of 1 Samuel. So turn back with me in the Old Testament, 1 Samuel chapter 1. This world and the 21st century culture has formed an idea, or is kind of, I don't know if it's committed fully to that, but there is the trend of what the successful woman is supposed to be like. Disney, Hollywood, and Broadway are determined to form that ideology that shapes our culture. And there's the commercialization of that ideology pumped on the airwaves, mainstream media all across the globe. It is a worldview, and the worldview trying to shape the world culture. And of course, nowadays, they're even shuffling and dodging away from the definition of what a woman actually is. And so they're obviously in their own trouble in trying to define a new woman and a new idea of what is a successful woman. They can't even define a woman. And that's the culture we're in. It is futile. It is a crazy, chaotic world with no moorings, no foundations, and nobody that we can look to in this culture to say they're the expert or they know what they're talking about, because they don't. And they're reaching for ideas that are based on things like fashion, diet, a body image, the gymnasium, careers, advancements, achievements, some type of leadership influence, some type of self-improvement, and grasping all these and putting it all in there and saying, okay, here's how we're going to define a successful woman. And the culture is heavily focused on that. Now, when you look at the Bible and you search these things out, you find something quite different, quite different. If I were to ask you what a successful woman is, how would you answer that from the Bible? What does she look like? And the answer actually is not given to us in terms of success, but rather these terms: honor, honorable, or praised. That's the Proverbs 31. She shall be praised, blessed by those around her. In other words, she is worthy of some high esteem by those who see her, who measure her, and look at her and say, yes, this is definitely a life that is blessed and honored and favored. And if you look further and really examine this out a little bit more, you come to find out that this definition of a successful woman or an honored woman is a moral definition. There's a moral definition to it. There's a spiritual quality to it. There's a respectful nature because of her character, her integrity, not in what she's achieved in the world of business or wealth or influence. I cringe at those terms, an influencer. This person is an influencer. In what way is this person an influencer? In corruption? That's someone to avoid. And here is this idea in the Bible. It's not determined by how much money she has. It's not determined by what leadership roles she fills. It's not determined by what influence in feministic culture she serves, or measured by the achievements of business and social justice. Instead, it's measured by what God thinks. That biblical woman is so foreign to our modern ideas of success and value. It's as if she's too old-fashioned, too counterintuitive to the values that the culture around us want to consider as achievement, as good, as worthy to follow or honor. But what matters really is not that, from what the world says. Because what profit is it to gain the whole world and the opinions of the world and get in line with the earthly achievements when you forfeit your soul in doing so? What matters most is whether God honors and favors this person. So this Mother's Day, I want us to look at an example of that. And I read from you from 1 Peter 5, and you're going to see an example of 1 Peter 5 on the pages of the Old Testament. And this woman, her name is Hannah. Hannah, in 1 Samuel, takes up the dominating person or character in the first couple chapters of this historical book that begins about Samuel himself, but really leads to one great man that is down the road, and we know him as King David. But it starts with Hannah. So let's look this Mother's Day. Take a trip way back to a very archaic woman, a very old, dusty picture of an old-fashioned type of person who is presented to us as an honorable woman. And we'll learn from her characters, and we'll learn from her qualities, and we want to follow this pattern. We want to encourage this. Amongst the church, we do not want the society around us to tell us what is the right way to go here, what's favorable and honorable. We want God to tell us that. We want to see the examples. As the Bible says, you look to these examples, they're given to us so that we might learn from them. Learn to not follow in the sinful patterns and learn to follow in the honorable, favorable, godly, righteous patterns. And here is one of them, this woman named Hannah. Now, there's a couple of things. There's some characteristics about her life, and we're going to walk through these first two chapters here and just kind of walk our way through the narrative, and I want you to see this woman. I want to see her character and qualities. Let's start with, and you have to start with the context, Hannah's challenges. It's our first point we want to look at. What was it that Hannah was living in and was affecting her and how she responded to those things? These are Hannah's challenges. Let me read the first eight verses of 1 Samuel chapter 1. There was a certain man. Just notice the words that are picked here. A certain man, not anybody specific, not anybody of high influence, but just a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim of the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, son of Elihu, son of Tohu, son of Zuph, an Ephrathite. And I just want to, from the beginning here, all those names don't mean anything to me. I have no idea who they are. I do know an Ephraimite, one of the tribes of Israel, so this is an Israelite. That's the best we can go with. And I know the Ephraimite tribe comes from a son of Joseph. That's pretty impressive. The younger son of Joseph, Manasseh, is the other one, and the Lord, through his providence, divided that family and gave them two tribal allotments amongst the 12 tribes of Israel. But technically, Ephraim and Manasseh aren't even children of Jacob. They're grandchildren. But that's neither here nor there. It's just these names. Who's Tohu? Don't name your son Tohu. Zuf. Okay. It's just part of the genealogy. It's to connect these people to show you they're Israelite. They belong here. There's a place within their society, within their allotment, and within whatever respect and honor that honor-shame culture would give them based upon their heritage and family. Okay, so we just start with that. Verse 2, he had two wives. That tells us a little bit about the challenges she is in. The name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other, Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. Now this man used to go up year by year from his city to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts at Shiloh, where the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests of the Lord. On the day when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah he gave a double portion, because he loved her, though the Lord has closed her womb. And her rival used to provoke her grievously to irritate her, because the Lord had closed her womb. So it went on year by year. As often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she used to provoke her. Therefore Hannah wept and would not eat. And Elkanah, her husband, said to her, "Hannah, why do you weep, and why do you not eat, and why is your heart so sad? Am I not more to you than 10 sons?" So here is her condition. Here is her circumstances. We'll just say it that way. Here's this woman set in this particular time, in this particular family, under this particular husband, with another wife, and she's in this home, and it is a challenge. So the first thing we really are introduced to here in these challenges, how ordinary, how obscure she is, where she comes from. She's no queen. She's no wealthy aristocrat. There's nothing about Elkanah that says he ruled these people. He was the head or chief of the tribes. It just says he's a husband, part of this family. There's no powerful leader in her social strata. That's not who she is. She doesn't have a name, nor come from a family of names. It's just part of the Israelite tribes. So the first thing you see the obscurity of it. That's what connects us to her. How powerful are we? What influence do we have? And here we have this woman. She comes from a family of Ephraim, married to a man who's taken a second wife and is seen as the lesser, unfortunate wife of the two. That's the perspective. That's the challenge she faces. In other words, she has everything working against her that would give her honor in the eyes of society. Now think about that. Let me build this out a little bit. Starting with the historical challenge on this challenge that she has. So here she is, just an ordinary, obscure individual out of just a tribe that isn't particularly important. There's this historical challenge that is, the time in which 1 Samuel is written is a time when Israel is not doing well, when Israel is just coming out of or part of what is the time of the judges. And if you know anything of the book of the time of the judges, you read the book of Judges, you find 350 years of roller coaster rides of unfaithfulness, judgment, being rescued out of trouble, and they're just going round and round, and they're trouble and there's struggle. There's great challenge to be an Israelite for 350 years, and nothing has changed. And here she is in this time under that type of condition. Now, there's someone who's mentioned in this passage, verse 3, is the priest Eli and his two sons Hophni and Phinehas, and they're serving at Shiloh at this time. This is way before the time of the tabernacle of Solomon that would be built in a permanent structure in Jerusalem. And so the tabernacle where the children of Israel would come and sacrifice would be the tent that Moses had made, and it rested in the city of Shiloh, which is in the center of Ephraim, the tribal lot of Ephraim. So they're fairly close to this, and they would travel to this place. And Eli would be the priest. Hophni and Phinehas would be his sons. And if I could say anything about them, the priesthood of Eli was less than desirable. So the time of Judges really hasn't changed, if you could say it that way. And this is, we're talking about the worship now of Israel is compromised. This man was not one who had his own personal disciplines in place. He was a poor leader of his sons. He installed morally unqualified priests, his own sons, to serve at the altar of the Lord. Whether he had power to do that or not, I would say he had influence on that. And yet what we'll find out about Hophni and Phinehas, they're corrupt, immoral, disqualified individuals, and the Lord will take them out very quickly here. So this is what's going on. This is the challenge she's living in. Eli seems like he's a powerless person to change their corruption. He misjudges a godly woman, as we'll see in a bit here. He's looking at this godly woman, Hannah, doesn't realize she's a godly woman, thinks she's a woman who is a compromised sinner. Misjudgment. This is just a picture of the times. Eli and Hophni. So this is the challenge she faces historically. There's also the physical obstacle. There's another challenge. It says here at the end of verse 2, Hannah had no children. Why? It says later, because the Lord had closed her womb. She was not able to have children. There is a barrenness in her. It seems to be a common trait among some of the women that God raised up in the Old Testament. Go back to Rachel, barren. Go back to Rebecca, barren. Go back to Sarah, barren. And the Lord then, in his work, in his healing of them and enabling them to have children, would then form the nation of Israel. And this would be another one. But to not have children is not a thing to celebrate in that culture. It's a thing to be sorrowful for. You get married and you multiply and you want to bring sons for your husband, for the heritage and for the passing on of the traditions and the property. Everything was bound around the children that would come, and she was not enabled to provide, which may be the reason why you have a second wife, her name Peninnah. So here's this obstacle. She cannot bring children, and this is her big grief. This is what's central to chapter 1 and chapter 2 is her desire to bring forth children and raise up a godly generation. That's an honorable woman, but she's prevented from doing that. The cultural shame that goes with that, and sometimes when I say this, shame is ascribed for good reason. There should be shame for some reasons. If you move ahead forward where you have Eli accusing her as he sees her thinking she's drunk. How long will you go, verse 14, on being drunk? Put your wine away from you, accusing her of shame. And she says, don't regard your servant as a worthless woman. So there are worthless women in the culture at that time, and they deserve that shame because of their behavior. So there's good reason for shame. Other times, shame is a cultural construct or culturally ascribed and has nothing to do with the person's moral character. And that's the case with Hannah. But the shame is there. Personal responsibilities. An unjust shame in this case. She can't control that. And yet, there is this grief, and yet there is this provoking that comes from the other woman. So having children was culturally a strong social norm, customary mark of blessing, a strong opinion that to not have children means that God's disfavor towards you, and so that was the assumption. It was a wrong assumption. It's an unjust assumption, but this is the challenge she lives in. And here's Hannah. How is she going to respond to that? A married woman, and here's this other woman, Peninnah, because probably, doesn't say specifically, she couldn't have children, so he got another wife to have children. But there's still this idea, he loved her more than he did Peninnah, because he gave her the double honor the double portion, verse 5, every time they went up to worship. So there's something going on there, and there's no honor really being given to Elkanah by that. But this is the challenge. We just want to see that. This man became a polygamist. In order to have children, a good desire to have children through inordinate, ungodly means. And so here is Hannah in the midst of all this, which results in this relationship grief. In verse 6, her rival. So her rival is Peninnah, but she's a rival. Used to provoke her grievously to irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb. So went on year after year. As often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she used to provoke her. So this Peninnah is not a godly woman. This is Peninnah is wicked, is evil, is ruthless, rubbing it in. I have children. I'm able to provide for my husband, but you're under the disfavor of the Lord and provoking her in this way. So there's this relationship grief, and I don't think it's helped by Elkanah, as you see in verse 8. Elkanah, her husband, came to her and said to her, Hannah, why do you weep? Why do you not eat? And why is your heart sad? Am I not more to you than 10 sons? I'm just curious about that response. Am I not worth more to you than 10 sons? Almost a tone-deaf counseling, you know? What? The problem here is that she can't have children, can't provide, can't raise a generation, and just be happy you got me. That's the answer. So there's some relationship grief, struggle going on here in her life. These are the challenges, but I want to add one more. Sovereign purpose. The sovereign purpose of God, it says here specifically, closed her womb. He prevented this. He has a plan. And thus his plan included her in this challenge, this trial. And remember 1 Peter 5, humble yourselves under God. And at the due time, the proper time, he will exalt you. Right now is not the proper time. And she has to endure through this challenge. Desperately praying, wrestling with the Lord in prayer. The Lord is going to hear her prayer. But at this particular point, here's her challenge. Here's her grief. This is the challenge she's in. It's now a matter how will she respond to these challenges. How does a godly person react to such challenges? What does faith look like here? If I can't get what I want, and it's a good thing, I want children, I can't get that, how does faith respond? How do I honor the Lord in this? How did Job respond when his children were killed in one day? I will not curse God and die. I will bless God. I will trust God in this process. So whatever the challenges you may face, you could be faithful, a God-pleasing, God-honoring person in the midst of it. You just need to learn what that means. No matter the sins of those around you that affect you, and there's sin going on here, provoked, irritated, constantly in the home, no matter those sins that you may have to overcome, there is a way of escape, and the Lord will carry you through. The Lord is in charge of this situation. So here's the challenges of Hannah. And I want you to see now Hannah's faith. Hannah's faith shows up here in verse 9. So all this is going on, and it sets the course for her. And in verse 9, let me read from that to verse 18. And they had eaten and drunk in Shiloh. Hannah rose after that. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat beside the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. She was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. And she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant and remember me and not forget your servant, but will give to your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall touch his head. As she continued praying before the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was speaking in her heart, only her lips moved, and her voice was not heard. Therefore Eli took her to be a drunken woman. And Eli said to her, how long will you go on being drunk? Put your wine away from you. But Hannah answered, no, my Lord, I'm a woman troubled in spirit. I've drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have been pouring out my soul before the Lord. Do not regard your servant as a worthless woman. For all along I've been speaking out of my great anxiety and vexation. Then Eli answered, go in peace, the God of Israel, that you have made to him. And she said, let your servant find favor in your eyes. Then the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. So here's this intervention that Eli steps in, thinking one, misjudging. And then in the end, as she explains that, he blesses her. And the priestly blessing, and actually blessings like this, are very significant throughout the Old Testament. So there's something to this. But I want you to see Hannah's faith in this. First, the persistent worship. Year by year, she's coming. Year by year, this is going on. And year by year, there's no answer to her trial here. She wants a son, and it's a good desire. She prays. She brings this to the Lord. It's a vexation to her. It's anxiety to her, and yet at the end, what she responds is peace. She goes back and eats, and her face is no longer sad. So there's this persistent worship. There's an affectionate petition. It shows her steadfast strength, her firm beliefs, her strong convictions in the Lord that he can resolve this. He can change this course. He can bring the humble and lift that humble person up and exalt her. She's under duress. She's under affliction. She's weeping. She's passionate. She's fervent in her prayer. That's a sign of a faith there, a godly faith. She's not demanding anything from God, as you can see in her words there in verse 11. O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant, take note of me. If it be your will, if it be your desire, remember me. Don't forget me in my affliction, in my struggle, in my vexation. It's a great petition, placing it in the hands of the Lord. She also gives this personal vow, which tells us here, as it says, I will dedicate him, I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life. No razor shall touch his head. She's referring to what's called the Nazarite vow. That's in Numbers chapter 6, verse 4 to 8. And there's three things, basically, the Nazarite was not to do: drink wine, cut his hair, or touch a dead body. And so there's this vow he would take to serve God in this way. And these acts are ways to show your commitment to that. Samson had a lifetime vow towards that. John the Baptist probably had the same type of vow. And here is another that she's saying, I'm going to give Samuel to this. I'm going to dedicate him in this way. Obviously, Samuel, her son, he's not here yet, but Samuel will be the one that the Lord will use and raise up for things to come. And she's just vowing, I'm going to dedicate my son to serve you, God, if you bless me in this way, if you answer my prayer. So there's this theological trust. There's this worship. There's this faith. Add to that the marriage relationship. You could see Elkanah and Hannah are going year by year up to the house of the Lord, year by year offering these offerings and praying, both of them having the same shared desires. I'm sure he would desire a son. He would desire her to have children. And so there's something of this bond, this relationship. All of that is where her faith is being exercised right now. Everyone involved. It's her relationship with Peninnah that is the problem. And she's not responding back in Peninnah, by the way, by fighting and lashing out and fighting back. You know what she does? She takes that conflict, places it in the hands of the Lord, and prays to God. Says, I will not respond. I will not feed this fire. I will not let this destroy me. I will give it to God, and my anxiety and my petitions will be in the hands of the Lord. Here is why she is a woman of faith, a heroine of sorts. Maybe not a leader in the battlefield, not a politician, not a queen, not a prophetess. All she is in the story is this hopeful mother. Think about that. Obscure wife, obscure mother, strong affection in her heart for the Lord, praying fervently, believing God can answer that prayer if he will. She's a woman of prayer, woman of worship, woman of her word. If you do this, I will dedicate the child. She'll follow through with that. A woman of praise, a woman of purity, a woman who wanted to honor God, give her best to serve God. She called herself a servant, your servant, Lord. That's the type of woman that we have here that is honored. It's honorable in the eyes of God. And will God remember her? Oh, you bet he will. Okay, so this is her faith on display on the pages. Simple individual. I mean, of all the families of this of Israel this time, in that generation, wherever they are, here is this one that the Old Testament text puts a focus on. An obscure person from a tribe of Ephraim, not a special tribe, just an average one. Judah's the special tribe. Ephraim, okay. Well, what does God do? How does he answer this? Does he ignore her? Does he forget her? Well, verse 19. Let me show you God's favor. God's favor. They rose early in the morning and worshiped before the Lord. Then they went back to their house at Ramah. And Elkanah knew Hannah, his wife, and the Lord remembered her. There's the answer to the petition. And in due time, Hannah conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Samuel, for she said, I've asked for him from the Lord. The man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice and to pay his vow. But Hannah did not go up, for she said to her husband, as soon as the child is weaned, I will bring him so that he may appear in the presence of the Lord and dwell there forever. Elkanah, her husband, said to her, do what seems best to you. Wait until you have weaned him. Only may the Lord establish his word. So the woman remained and nursed her son until she weaned him. And when she had weaned him, she took him up with her, along with a three-year-old bull and an ephah of flour and a skin of wine. And she brought him to the house of the Lord at Shiloh. And the child was young. Then they slaughtered the bull and they brought the child to Eli. And she said, oh, my Lord, as you live, my Lord, I am the woman who was standing here in your presence praying to the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition that I made to him. Therefore, I have lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is lent to the Lord. And he worshiped the Lord there. And here's the outcome of this. God's favor. He remembered her. I want you to note Eli. I don't think Eli remembered her. She's like, do you remember me? I think so. I'm not sure. But the Lord remembered her. The Lord was thoughtful of her. Notice these terms. Her prayer, don't forget your servant. He didn't. He remembered is the terms. And in answer to the prayer, he granted her this son. He does not forget. He's always thoughtful. We're always in his mind and his thoughts. Nobody is unimportant in this way. As we pray to God, as we bring our griefs to God, God is gracious, God is merciful, God is loving, God is compassionate. He's a comforter to those who grieve, as he was to Hannah. And here's this dedicated mother, naming him Samuel, which means heard by God, proceeds to wean the child and care for him, prepare him for what would be a lifetime service to the Lord. And she would lend him to the Lord all the days of his life. A woman of her word. And God's favor is upon her at this place, at this point. Vows are very important. As Jesus said, let your yes be yes and your no be no. And her yes is yes. I'm going to do this. Samuel is going to be handed over. Samuel is going to be raised here and we're going to care for him in this way. He's going to serve God. However God sees fit. See, God honors the humble. God honors the faithful. The servants of the Lord. Whatever their circumstances in life, he answers the prayers. He involves them in his sovereign will and plans. And there's going to be a plan here. And Samuel is going to be central to it. The two books, 1 and 2 Samuel, are named after him. A very significant man of God in the history of Israel, coming from this prayer that is answered to this woman who is barren, suffering, and just wanted to raise the son to honor God in a godly man for the next generation. God honored that. God involved her. He uses the simple things to carry out his great purposes. A simple childless woman, and in this story, this culture, this society, her rival thought she deserved dishonor. It was God who favored her. Okay? God's favor. Let me take you fourthly, Hannah's gratefulness. This all happens, and there's this expression in this time of worship in chapter 2. A great statement here. This is likened to Mary, the mother of our Lord. It was called the Magnificat in Luke chapter 1. This text here is very similar to that. Chapter 2, verse 1 to 10. Look at Hannah's gratefulness. And Hannah prayed and said, "My heart exalts in the Lord. My strength is exalted in the Lord. My mouth derides my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. There is none holy like the Lord. There is none besides you. There is no rock like our God. Talk no more so very proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth. For the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty are broken, but the feeble bind in strength. Those who are full have hired themselves out for bread, but those who are hungry have ceased to hunger. The barren has borne 7, but she who has many children is forlorn. The Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low, he exalts. He raises up the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with princes and inherit a seat of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and on them he has set the world. He will guard the feet of his faithful ones, but the wicked shall be cut off in darkness, for not by might shall a man prevail. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Against them he will thunder in heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the power of his anointed." And Elkanah went home to Ramah, and the boy ministered to the Lord in the presence of Eli the priest. Here is her praise, her gratefulness. Kind of a prayer, but really it's a praise. And it's very theological. This is a person who knows her Bible. This is a person who knows the book of the law. She knows the history of Moses. She knows the history of God's deliverance of the children of Israel. She knows the God who is the only God, the only rock which they sang of. She's very familiar with this. She's a theologically minded person. She exalts God, verse 1 and 2. You have God's justice, verse 3 to 4. You see God's sovereign will lifted up. He does this, brings high and brings down. He humbles the proud and lifts up the humble. It's the sovereign will of God. That's his purposes. His goodness to the faithful, he shows. He will guard the feet of his faithful ones, but the wicked shall be cut off in darkness. So we have this God here that she is clinging to and believing in, now giving praise to and honor as she sees in her own little world, answer to a prayer. I was humbled and debased, and God lifted me up and blessed me with a child, and I dedicate him to the Lord, and may God be honored and glorified through this. And she is doing that very thing. What an expression that is. Coming from her former bitterness is now a heart of joy, celebration in the ways of the Lord. It's not, look at me, I now have a son. It is, look at the Lord and what he has done and who he is. So the pride of Peninnah humiliated, the humble character of Hannah lifted up. Her simple world. These redemptive truths that are true throughout the whole Bible are applicable even to her and her tiny little world. I don't even know if she has any idea what Samuel is going to become. I don't think the Lord indicated to her, but if she is thinking and if she lives 300 years and backs up here and takes a look at what happens, she could say exactly the same thing she said here is exactly how God will work in Samuel's life as well. Bring down the proud, raise up the humble. He will do his work, and he will do it well, and he will bring blessing to the faithful. The woman of honor is a woman of rich theology, biblical knowledge, wisdom, a grasp of the God of the Bible. She knows God's power. She knows God's goodness. She also knows God's righteous judgment and his mercy. Both of them go together. God is righteous. He is just. And he will bring judgment upon the wicked. And he'll be merciful, though, as well. She understands these truths. She exalts God in worship because of them. She is grateful simply because the Lord gave her a child. And she saw in that the picture of God, the purpose of the God, the attributes of God, the glories of God. And that's a great, great worshipful heart. grateful. It's a high value of children, high value of family, her role as a mother, her place in society now as she thinks about what's my next step forward. I'm going to raise this child. I'm going to dedicate this child. I'm going to thank God in this and worship God as a result. What a grateful heart. That's Hannah's gratefulness. And that's followed up with Hannah's care. Hannah's care. Jump ahead to verse 18. I'll get back to the previous verses here, but verse 18. Samuel, this child, was ministering before the Lord, a boy clothed with a linen ephod. And his mother used to make for him a little robe and take it to him each year when she went up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. So Samuel is dedicated. He is now raised in the temple grounds, in the tabernacle area. Eli would oversee that. You'll see that later on in the chapters of 1 Samuel if you read ahead. But she comes and does visits and provides and cares and loves on her child. Verse 20, and Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife and say, may the Lord give you children by this woman for the petition she asked of the Lord, so that then they would return to their home. Indeed, the Lord visited Hannah. She conceived and bore three sons, two daughters, and the young man Samuel grew in the presence of the Lord. There is Hannah's care and the Lord's blessing in that, mother's love, God's favor, all of this working together. Despite Eli's questionable character, that priestly blessing means something here. The first blessing resulted in God answering the prayer, or is tied to that. This second blessing is also tied to the next blessing in their life. Five more kids, three sons, two daughters, a full family. And that in the eyes of the culture is now she's favored, viewed as favored and blessed, but we're not caring about that. We care about God's actual favor, and he does bless this woman of faith. So here's her care. Continues to remember her. This is a domesticated woman. She's responsibilities at home with these children, raising them up and raising Samuel and caring for him that God would be honored in their life. She loves her son. She loves the Lord. She lends her son in his service. God is worthy to be served. God is worthy to be honored in this way with our family, with our children. Safe to say, she faithfully taught her son the law, and she taught her children the law of the Lord as she knew it. Deuteronomy 6, teach your children and your children's children who God is that you serve and worship. Tell them about his ways. Don't forget the Lord. Remember the Lord in this way. And she, I'm sure, is faithful in that way. That's her care. Let me take you lastly. We'll close up with this. The end of an era. What has this got to do with anything? I mean, it's a great story about a mother, God answering prayer, a faithful woman, and how the Lord remembers and looks in on an individual in the midst of Israel, and Israel that's kind of not good. The priests ain't too good. The priest's sons are wicked individuals. We'll see that in a second here. And the Lord's eyes are towards the faithful, towards the simple woman, obscure woman that's practically forgotten and misjudged by Eli the priest. What is the Lord doing here? What's going on? What's the point of all this? Why is this here? It has to do with this. It's coming to the end of an era. It's placed here amongst all the possible storylines of different families, whether they be rulers, chiefs of tribes, politicians, judges, whatever. Out of all the possible storylines, God chose this one here, this little insignificant in the eyes of the world, frowned upon by the culture, picked on by her rival, counterintuitive to the things how they ought to turn out. God chose this, placed it here, work through it, because the story of David is intricately tied to it. It's tied to the story of Samuel, who is the kingmaker. Samuel would be the one who would install the kings, and he would really bring the nation back to faithfulness, or directing their eyes. Not that the nation followed him all the time, nor his sons, but this is an end of an era. We're moving out of the judges, and we're about to begin the time of the kings, of which David would be chief on this. And this son would anoint David. The significance of this. This all kind of comes out in the stream of God's plans all starting with a prayer from this faithful, barren, childless woman, a godly woman. The end of an era. Let me read these. Verse 12. Verse 12. Now the sons of Eli were worthless men. You don't want to be called that by the Bible. Worthless men. Ah. They did not know the Lord. That's where it all begins. There's the heart of it. They did not pursue wisdom. They did not fear the Lord, which is the beginning of wisdom. Instead, they loved themselves. They were worthless men. The custom of the priest with the people was that when any man offered a sacrifice, the priest's servant would come while the meat was boiling with a three-pronged fork in his hand, and he would thrust it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot. All that the fork brought up, the priest would take for himself. This is what they did at Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there. Moreover, before the fat was burned, the priest's servant would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, "Give meat for the priest to roast, for he will not accept boiled meat from you, but only raw." And if a man said to him, "Let them burn the fat first, then take as much as you wish," he would say, "No, you must give it now, and if not, I will take it by force." Thus the sin of the young men was very great in the sight of the Lord, for the men treated the offering of the Lord with contempt. In other words, what is described here is this is not what priests should be doing. This is not how Moses and his instructions to the priests in Leviticus would describe your actions. Instead, they took advantage of that, they abused their power, and they made themselves fat off of it. Contempt is really the mark of this priesthood. And there's a necessary righteous judgment that will need to happen here. Samuel will fill the void of this unfaithfulness. He will lead the nation in this time of turmoil. We don't want these guys leading the nation. They are causing great harm. They're worthless men, is the idea. Then verse 22, moving ahead. Eli was very old, and he kept hearing all that his sons were doing to all Israel and how they lay with the women who were serving at the entrance to the tent of meeting. Just add on the sin and the moral corruption right there, immorality. And he said to them, "Why do you do such things? For I hear of your evil dealings from all the people. No, my sons, it's not good report that I hear the people of the Lord spreading abroad. If someone sins against a man, God will mediate it for him. But if someone sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him?" In other words, you're a priest. You don't have a mediator. You are the mediator. And as you sin before the eyes of the Lord and flaunt this and treat the Lord with contempt, you have to answer to God. Now, those are wise words from Eli. I don't know about his parenting. I don't know what happened here. I don't know if his words are even heard, and they're not heard. They didn't listen. Says here, they would not listen to the voice of their father, for it was the will of the Lord to put them to death. That is the consequences of their behavior right there. He just shut their ears and hardened their hearts even further than they already were, because they were going to face a judgment from God. But at least Eli, in some way, towards the end here, is stepping up. But I don't know what happened before that. I don't know why these two priests are in this place in the first place. It just tells me a lot is bad. A lot is corrupt. They've hardened themselves, their obstinate hearts towards any reproof from their father. And they're not even going to respond to this. They're not afraid of God at all. But they should be. And moving ahead, verse 27. 26 and 27. Now the young man Samuel continued to grow both in stature and favor in the Lord and also with man. He's going in the opposite direction, character-wise, than these other two, Hophni and Phinehas. And there came a man of God to Eli. Okay, so Eli said something, not heard. But now the man of God comes to Eli, the father, and said to him, "Thus the Lord has said, did I indeed reveal myself to the house of your father when you were in Egypt, subject to the house of Pharaoh? Did I choose him out of all the tribes of Israel to be my priest, to go up to my altar, to burn incense, to wear an ephod before me? I gave to the house of your father all my offerings by fire from the people of Israel. Why then do you scorn my sacrifices and my offerings that I commanded? and honor your sons above me by fattening yourselves on the choicest parts of every offering of my people. It sounds like the prophet is saying right here is, your words back there, kind of empty, kind of hypocritical. You're benefiting by what they're doing. Rather than stopping it, you just kind of gave this statement, oh, this is bad, you got a bad reputation. Why do you keep doing this evil and nagging on your sons? Well, it comes back on him. Verse 30, therefore the Lord, the God of Israel, declares, I promise that your house and the house of your father shall go in and out before me forever. But now the Lord declares, far be it from me. For those who honor me, I will honor, and those who despise me shall be lightly esteemed. Behold, the days are coming when I will cut off your strength and the strength of your father's house, so that there will not be an old man in your house. Then in distress, you will look with envious eye on all the prosperity that shall be bestowed on Israel, and there shall not be an old man in your house forever. The only one of you whom I shall not cut off from my altar shall be spared to weep his eyes out, to grieve his heart, and all the descendants of your house shall die by the sword of men. And this that shall come upon your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, shall be the sign to you. Both of them shall die on the same day. And I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who shall do according to what is in my heart and in my mind, and I will build him a sure house. And he shall go in and out before my anointed forever. And everyone who is left in your house shall come to implore him for a piece of silver or a loaf of bread, and shall say, please put in one of the priest's place. Put me in one of the priest's place that I may eat a morsel of bread. And this is humiliating, is what's happening here. What Hannah said in chapter 2 is going to happen to the house of Israel. You're up here, you're flaunting the Lord's privilege here, you're treating it with contempt. I'm going to humble you. I'm going to humble your sons, I'm going to bring down your house and raise up another house. That other house, theologians say, is probably the house of Zadok. It will come in the time of Solomon and a few generations ahead here. But here is this promise that God will replace the corruption and raise up one who will be faithful. Now, is that Samuel? Samuel will play a part of that. He, in the meantime, is faithfully growing in the Lord and serving God. This is a time where the era is changing. And God is going to remove and place persons in as he establishes the future of Israel going forward. And it's a great story because it's all connected really to this plan of God and the means of prayer of this woman. That's the means that this is going to be carried out here and worked out. And it's as if her praise in chapter 2 is a prophecy of things to come as they've already happened. It's just describing how the Lord is working, and this is how it's going to happen.